discreet pearl and diamond earrings caught the light. She wore jeans and a gossamer white shirt over a white lace camisole, a combination more elegant than I'd have imagined. Two booths over, a busboy wiped down the table with his eyes pinned on her, as though she might be a celebrity. "Have you ordered yet?" I asked. "I was waiting for you." The waitress returned with her order pad in hand. I asked for a small tomato juice, rye toast, and a soft-boiled egg. Rain ordered the breakfast special. When the meal came, I watched her work her way through orange juice, scrambled eggs, home fries, bacon, link sausages, and buttered biscuits with strawberry jam. Though she ate as rapidly as I did, I finished first, leaving her with two biscuits to go. "How old are you?" I asked.
"I'll be 25 in July. Why?"
"Please tell me you don't eat like that and then go to the ladies' room and barf it all up again."
"And waste all this food? I wouldn't dream of it."
"No laxatives, Ipecac? Finger down your throat?" She laughed. "I've got the metabolism of a bird." That's what the skinny actresses say to cover up their eating disorders. Not me. In my teens, I had migraines and I barfed enough for a lifetime. I admit I was pretty good at it, but eating's too much fun.
"Can I ask you about your father's business? Deborah says you took over after he died."
"I did. He was actually my grandfather, as I'm sure you know, but I called him Daddy because that's what he was to me. He owned a plant in downtown L.A. manufacturing sports uniforms. Later, he created a line of foul-weather gear. Raincoats, rain hats, anoraks, rain jackets, slickers, umbrellas." I stared at her.
"Are you talking about rain checks?"
"That's him."
"You're kidding.
You're the rain in rain checks?"
"Yep."
"How did he come up with the idea when California has so little rainfall? What is it, 15 days a year?"
"He was smart. Early in his career, he worked for a company that made sports apparel. He was on the road a lot, mostly in the Northwest, Oregon and Washington states. He could see the niche. People had raincoats, umbrellas, and boots, but it was all a hodgepodge, and none of it was stylish. He decided to tackle the high-end market, where Burberry and London Fog were the only competition. Now we sell through all the luxury department stores, Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, Bergdorf Goodman. We have a huge worldwide presence as well. London, Rome, Prague, Tokyo, Singapore. When foul weather threatens your day, take a rain check."
"I love those ads," I said. "You know how to run a business?"
"I'm learning," she said.
She popped the last bite of biscuit in her mouth and wiped her fingers on her napkin. "After Daddy died, I changed my major from social work to business and got my MBA. I have a team of experts holding my hand, and we've done well so far, knock on wood."
I am totally amazed.
"You're not the only one," she said. "Anyway, I know your primary interest is the kidnapping, abduction, or whatever. I'm curious about the experience."
"It was fine, really.
I was 4. I didn't know what was going on, so why would I react badly?"
"No unpleasant associations?"
"Not at all. The guys were nice. I got to play with this adorable yellow kitten. The only thing I was ever upset about was not getting to keep her when it was all over with."
"There were 2 guys?"
"2 that I saw. One was Santa, and the other was just this goofball who wore glasses with cardboard eyes in the frames and a big plastic nose. He had a wig, too, bright red fake hair like Raggedy Andy. There might have been other guys, but I doubt it.
Your mother says they made you a house out of a cardboard box."
"That was great. They put in a pile of blankets for a bed, and they cut windows along one side so I could look out. That's where I slept, though I didn't do much of it. They kept coaxing me into drinking lemonade laced with something. I'd get sleepy for a while, but I didn't stay down long. Whatever it was, it had the opposite effect. Instead of tired, I got wired. The more they gave me, the more amped I got."
"But no after effects?"
"None.
What about the box? Was it a carton an appliance might have come in? I guess. Not big enough for a refrigerator or a stove. I was little, but even then the box didn't seem gigantic. I'd say more or less the size of this table. Longer, but about as wide. You didn't miss your mom? Some, but they told me my mother wanted me to be a good girl, just for a little while, and then they'd take me home. And they stayed with you the whole time? One or the other did. Usually not both. I think that's why they wanted me asleep, to make their job easier. One would keep an eye on me while the other one left, probably to call my folks. Did you have nightmares afterward? Nope. Honestly, there was nothing traumatic about it. Weird as it sounds, I had a lot of fun. Her expression shifted when she caught sight of my face. What? I have trouble reconciling your experience with Mary Claire's disappearance. Clearly, these guys weren't thugs or hardened criminals. I can't believe they were kitty killers either, at least from what you've said. It sounds like they wanted money, and not very much of it at that. Somehow they were spooked into abandoning the $25,000, which was more than they got for you. You think something went wrong? I can't imagine any other explanation for the fact that you were released while she vanished forever. I feel guilty about that, and I have for years. If there's anything negative in the aftermath, it's knowing I escaped with my life. She wasn't as lucky. And look at the price she paid. Chapter 24. Walker McNally. Monday, April 18th, 1988. Walker took a seat near the back of the small conference room at the City Recreation Center. There was a separate door on the side of the building, its purpose to promote privacy. The furnishings were plain, folding chairs set up in ordered rows, a lectern that had been removed from its stand and placed on the floor. Wooden tables had been herded into a corner where they'd be out of the way. There were maybe 20 people in attendance, most keeping a chair or two between themselves and others. This was the third AA meeting he'd sat in on. The air smelled like construction paper and library paste. As an after-school project, the kids had cut out a number of tree silhouettes that were pinned to the bulletin board. "This is my family tree," was written across the bottom of each. The branches were covered with cut-out leaf shapes in primary colors, each bearing a name printed in block letters: Matthew, Jessica, Christopher, Ashley, Joshua, Heather. Walker could see leaves with the names of siblings as well, one or two leaves for Mom and Dad, depending on their marital status. A generation of grandparents appeared above the immediate family, with great-grandparents closer to the tippy-top. He doubted grade school kids could conceive of ancestors more remote in time. His sponsor was a guy named Leonard, whom he'd met through the Episcopal Church he and Carolyn attended sporadically. He'd been aware Leonard didn't drink. They had few acquaintances in common, though they ran into each other at the occasional dinner party. Leonard's wife, Shannon, was a kick, bright and funny, and Carolyn had been interested in getting the four of them together. Walker had resisted the idea. Being in Leonard's company was like being in the presence of a born-again, and Walker preferred to keep him at arm's length. Once Herschel laid down the law about Walker's pulling himself together, he'd called Leonard and talked to him about getting help. Leonard had agreed to sponsor him, and the two chatted frequently by phone. He was gradually warming to the man. He wanted his life back, and Leonard understood exactly where he was, even his ambivalence in the face of despair. He had to admit alcoholism was democratic, encompassing every age, race, social status, and financial standing. So far, he hadn't run into anyone he knew, but he was braced for the possibility. After his release from the hospital, he'd gone down to the police station with his attorney and surrendered himself to the authorities. The booking process had been matter of fact, for which he'd been inordinately grateful. He'd been more than cooperative, thinking to demonstrate that he was a cut above most of those who passed through their hands. It was a mark of how low he'd sunk that he deemed their opinions relevant. Later, at his arraignment, he'd pleaded not guilty, and now he was waiting for a court date. When the cops caught up with him after the accident, he'd been forced to surrender his driver's license, so he'd had to hire a car and driver to ferry him around town. Betty Sherrard, the bank vice president and portfolio manager, had offered a solution to the transportation problem. Her son, Brent, was living at home until school started in the fall. He was 20 and worked part-time stocking shelves at Vaughn's supermarket. He needed the extra money, and he was able to tailor his hours to accommodate Walker's needs. Walker paid him $15 an hour, plus mileage on his mother's spare car, a 1986 Toyota. It was all a pain in the ass, but he had no choice. The woman standing up in front was speaking about the trajectory of her drinking woes, a spiral as relentless as a toilet being flushed, according to her report. First, the family intervention, which had shocked her into good behavior. She'd been 1 year sober, and then her mother died, and she'd begun to drink again the day of the funeral. 3 months later, she swore off alcohol again, but there were countless falls from grace, each one more degrading than the one before. Her husband divorced her. She lost custody of her kids. She was a mean drunk, and her friends had taken to avoiding her. One morning, she woke up in her car, which was parked at a shopping mall 100 miles from home. She had no idea how she'd gotten there. Her purse had been stolen, and she'd had to hike to the nearest service station, where she bummed enough money to call and beg her ex-sister-in-law to pick her up. Waiting, she'd finally accepted the fact she couldn't do it on her own. Now, she was 51 days clean and sober, which netted her a big round of applause. Walker thought his circumstances were tame by comparison. True, Carolyn had forced him to leave the house, but he was confident she'd relent. He still saw his kids every chance he got, and he still had a job, for God's sake. He'd messed up badly, but his problems didn't hold a patch on some he'd heard here. This was a bump in the road, a wake-up call. He'd stumbled off course, and now he'd righted himself. All these stories about people losing everything and living on the streets. He sympathized, but his situation was entirely different. One guy had made it clean and sober for 5 years, 2 months, and 5 days. The best Walker could offer up was 7 days, not even worth one hand clapping. He'd have felt like a fool if he'd stood up and shared that. Belatedly, he flashed on the fact that while he'd been busy patting himself on the back, he'd forgotten about the girl he'd killed. Sitting there, he could feel his demons stir. It wasn't that he wanted a drink as such. It was the option to drink that he found hard to renounce. At some point in the future, 5 years or 10, he was unclear on the time frame, he wanted to believe he could enjoy a cocktail or a glass of wine. How many special occasions would come and go with him sipping soda water or a Diet Coke, detached and disengaged? Not drinking for the remainder of his life was too extreme a penalty. Surely he'd regain the privilege once he learned to moderate his intake. Carolyn would have told him he was kidding himself, but it wasn't true. He was grappling with his so-called drinking problem, and he was doing his best. How much more did she expect? He wanted a drink. He admitted it, especially now with this other business coming to the fore. The subject was like a cracked tooth he kept feeling with his tongue to see if the fissure had progressed. He checked his watch. 30 minutes yet. All he could think about was how burdened he was. Over the years, guilt had chafed at him, and now his only relief occurred during that magic moment when a drink went down and the warmth spread through his chest, untying the knots, loosening the noose around his neck. He was losing his capacity to tolerate the weight of anxiety that dogged him from day to day. How would he grow old with such a canker in his soul? An eternity later, the meeting ended, and the room emptied with a clatter of chairs being folded and stacked against the wall. He felt a touch on his arm that made him jump. "Fancy meeting you here." He turned. Avis Gent stood close by, in a spiky blaze of flaming red hair, the scent of whiskey pouring off her skin. Shit, he thought. Had she come to the meeting drunk? His right arm was still in a sling, so he didn't make a move to shake hands. Her eyes widened at the sight of his face. "Oh, I love that blend of purple and yellow. The black eyes make you look like a raccoon. You got yourself banged up good. I take it you heard about the accident. Me and everyone else. The whole of Horton Ravine is abuzz. Thanks. I'm feeling so much better for having talked to you." Walker hadn't seen Avis since their chance encounter on Via Giuliana, that nightmare of patrol cars, police personnel, and rumors of a dead child. He hadn't read a word in the paper about the incident, unless an article had appeared while he was in St. Terry's and out of commission. Avis wasn't looking good. He'd once thought her attractive, but the fluorescent lighting didn't do her any favors. In her current state of inebriation, her eyes were out of focus, and her loose-limbed swaying was such that he had to put a hand out to steady her. She said, "Whoa! I hope you didn't drive over here in this condition. I came by cab. My license was permanently yanked." "What a drag," she said. "And you?" "I have a kid who squires me around town." "Lucky you. How many meetings? Is this your first?" "Third," she smiled. "Clever move. Paying lip service so you'll look good when your case goes to trial. I've done the same thing myself." Her tone was bantering but smug, and it annoyed the shit out of him. "How's Carolyn holding up?" she asked, eyes wide with sympathy. "Great. She's been very supportive. A real brick." Avis made a face. "Well, that surprises me. I don't think of her as understanding." "She let you stay in the house?" "Not at the moment. I'm at the Pelican in Montebello, 2 blocks from the bank, which simplifies life to some extent. I still see the kids." She looked around the room, which was empty except for the two of them. "I don't suppose you could give me a ride home. I'm low on cash, and the taxi over cost me $20. We could have a quick drink." "Jesus, Avis, would you give it a rest?" She laughed. "It was a joke. Not a funny one." "Oh, lighten up. This isn't the end of the world. Thanks for your encouragement. Nice seeing you. Have a good life." "Goodbye to you, too. Change your mind. You know where I am. Second house on the right as you turn on Alita Lane." He moved past her, crossing to the exit, aware that she followed him with her gaze as he stepped out of the room. 4 middle-aged men were standing on the patio, smoking, oversized coffee cups in hand. This was the life that awaited him. Endless cups of coffee and a cloud of cigarette smoke. Avis, still plastered, represented the other end of the spectrum, which was no more attractive than the one in front of him. How had he ended up in this hell on earth? Brent was parked across the street. Walker waved, and he started the car, swinging around the block to pick him up. Walker got in the back seat. Sitting up front with Brent was a little too chummy for his taste. Fortunately, Brent was discreet, and he knew his place. He and Walker exchanged only the most banal of remarks. Walker didn't want to be Brent's buddy, and he was sure Brent wasn't interested in being his. This was a business arrangement, and Brent seemed to understand that Walker didn't want to hear his observations or opinions. Brent conducted himself as though he were invisible, squiring Walker from one place to the next without comment. Walker stared out the window as Brent navigated through the heart of town, following Capillo to the top of the hill. At the crest, he turned right on Palisade. The The road curved down to Harley's Beach and up the hill again on the far side. The route took them through the back entrance to Horton Ravine, stone pillars marking the outer limits of the enclave. Earlier in the day, Walker had called Carolyn, asking if she objected to his stopping by after his AA meeting to pick up a load of clothes. He passed off the reference to AA as an afterthought, but he knew it would register with her, perhaps winning him points. When possible, he avoided the motel he'd moved into. He'd have preferred a place with more class, the Edgewater Hotel being his first choice, but he didn't want to give Carolyn the impression he was being extravagant. She was already pissed off about the money he paid Brent, but what was he supposed to do? Take public transportation? He could just picture himself on a city bus. The Pelican Motel was perched on a rise overlooking the main road through what was known as the Lower Village in Montebello. The building had a drab air about it, just the place for a penitent. All he needed was a hair shirt and a cat of nine tails, and he'd be set. Brent pulled up in front of his house and parked. Walker let himself out of the back seat, wondering what Brent's impression was. The place looked good. He'd never liked the word quaint, but that's how it struck him now. This charming home was forbidden turf until he'd straightened up his act. Carolyn was the keeper of the gate. He'd have to kiss serious butt for the rest of his life to get back into her good graces. The very idea made him tired. The pretense, the carefully guarded behavior, the facade of virtue when all he wanted was the life he'd had before. Plus a drink, he thought. Brent accompanied him to the door. Politely, Walker rang the bell, feeling like a door-to-door salesman with a trainee at his side and a traveling case full of wares. When Carolyn opened the door, she scarcely looked at him. She said, "Oh, it's you," like she was expecting someone else and had suffered a disappointment. He thought a pleasant greeting would have been nice, some semblance of goodwill for the children's sake. At the moment, they were off at school, and Carolyn was having none of it. Brent didn't warrant a greeting of any kind, so Walker should have been grateful she spoke to him at all. She turned away and proceeded down the hall, talking to him over her shoulder. "I'll be in the kitchen. Let me know when you're done. I put the mail on the table. Remind me, and I'll tell you about a call I should have mentioned before." Walker wondered if she was worth the effort it would take to win her back. She'd lord it over him from this point on. She had all the power, and he was the supplicant, begging to see the kids, begging for an audience with the queen, begging for attention, which she decided was undeserved. In return for crumbs, she'd want all his paychecks deposited to her account. She'd dole out a few bucks to him from week to week. Not enough for a binge, but a modest sum, she'd say, was his to do with as he pleased. Maybe he'd appeal to the pastor of the church, citing Christian forbearance as a means of bringing her to heel. Ha, like that would do any good. He went upstairs with Brent tagging behind. Walker's ribs still pained him, and he wasn't allowed to lift anything, which was why Brent was forced to follow him around like a dog. Walker went into the walk-in closet and pushed through the hangers on his side of the hanging rods. With his left hand, he pulled out a sports coat, four suits, his raincoat, and his leather jacket, passing them to Brent, who laid them on the bed while Walker went through the dresser drawers, removing underwear, socks, and t-shirts. He'd have to borrow a suitcase or go down to the kitchen and find a paper bag to carry all his stuff. He went out into the hall and looked in the storage area under the eaves. After a grubby search, he came up with a duffel into which he jammed the pile of personal items. Idly, he wondered what would happen if he just walked away from the entire situation. He'd pack the car, cancel credit cards, empty all the bank accounts, and leave the state. By the time Carolyn realized what he'd done, he'd be out of her grasp. He pictured her at Saks, pricey merchandise piled up on the counter, while the saleswoman rang the sale and returned her card, looking mystified. "I'm sorry, Mrs. McNally, but this was declined." Declined? There must be a mistake. My husband pays our bills in full the first of every month. Would you like to try another card? She'd pull out her Visa or MasterCard, her embarrassment mounting as one after the other was rejected. Without him busting his ass to keep the coffers full, her life would grind to a halt. She didn't have a dime of her own. She was dependent on him for everything. The problem was, if he stuck it to her, he'd be sticking it to his kids. He didn't want Fletcher and Linny to suffer, which meant he'd be tied to Carolyn for all eternity. Brent made a couple of trips to the car, ferrying Walker's clothes. Meanwhile, Walker went into the kitchen where Carolyn was unloading the dishwasher, a job she'd always insisted was half his to share. He stood and watched her, making no effort to pitch in, a gesture she noticed but refrained from remarking on. Looking at her without the filter of affection, he realized she wasn't pretty anymore, and she was picking up weight. She was thick through the middle, and her pants were riding up. Maybe his losing the marriage wasn't such a big deal after all. He had wealthy women clients who'd made it clear they were interested in him. He'd been bemused by their attentions, but he might be more receptive now that he was on his own. Where would Carolyn find a guy willing to take her on, a plump, menopausal woman with two kids underfoot? He leaned against the counter. "You said something about the mail?" "It's out on the hall table, in a manila envelope. You must have walked right by." "Fine. What about the phone message?" "Oh, right. This was last week, and I apologize. It completely slipped my mind. A woman called and asked for you. Someone you went to high school with. She said she was a private eye, and she was looking for your dad." "Dad?" "That's what I said. She wanted to get in touch with him."
"What for?"
"I don't know. She told me, but it went in one ear and out the other. It didn't sound all that urgent."
"What did you tell her?"
"I didn't tell her anything. I hung up on her." He thought about it, wondering what he'd missed.
What would a private investigator want with Dad?
"Why are you asking me? I don't have a clue." He stared at her, trying to make sense of what she'd said.
"Did you get her name?"
"Milhone. I forget the first. Something odd. Kinsey? You remember her? I thought she was feeding me a line of bullshit."
"Senior year, we had a class together," he said, distracted.
"What did she want again?"
"Walker, I just told you. I have no idea. Something about a dog." She didn't say anything more than that.
The floor shifted under his feet. For a moment, he thought there'd been a tumbler. He put out his left hand and grabbed the counter with Carolyn looking on like he was losing it. He murmured an excuse and left the house, not even sure later how he got to the car. He felt like he'd been walking, looking in the other direction, and slammed into a door. The shock was making the blood drain out of his head, taking his blood pressure down along with it. His body was shot through with a clamminess that carried nausea in its wake. The outside air helped. He leaned against the car, feeling shaken to the core. Brent slammed down the trunk.
"Are you all right, Mr. McNally?"
"I'm fine. Let's get moving, if you don't mind."
"Sure thing."
Walker got in the back seat. Brent fired up the engine and was on the verge of pulling away when Carolyn called from the front door and then trotted down to the car. Walker lowered the rear window.
"You forgot the mail," she said.
She leaned down to look at him.
"Are you all right? The way you bolted out of there, I thought you'd seen a ghost."
Walker wanted to make a withering reply, but Brent was sitting in range and he didn't want to make a scene. He took the mail and dropped it on the seat beside him.
"Fuck you," he said under his breath.
He pushed the switch that rolled the window up so Carolyn was forced to yell through the glass.
"Fine. I'm sorry I asked."
Brent drove along Ocean Way toward the stone pillars at the rear of Horton Ravine. Walker said, "On my way back to the Pelican, I'd like to see my father. He's at Valley Oaks. I'll direct you once we get there." "No problem." Walker glanced out the window and realized they were passing John Corso's house. John still lived in the sprawling, two-story, gray-shingled monstrosity his father and stepmother had bought when John was 16. Walker hadn't met John until their senior year at Santa Teresa High, but he'd heard plenty about the amazing Mona and her three perfect daughters. John had confessed to screwing all three before each went off to college. The sisters were married now and living in the East with an assortment of kids. 2 years before, when Lionel died of a heart attack, Mona packed up and moved to New York so she'd be closer to her girls and all the grandkids. She'd inherited the house and the bulk of Lionel's estate. John's inheritance was $10,000 and a life interest in the studio apartment above the garage. Since the business with Mary Claire, John insisted that Walker keep his distance, so they'd never discussed the issue. Nonetheless, Walker knew to a certainty that John was still chafing at the paltry sum he'd been left. He earned staggering sums from the sales of his books, so it wasn't about the money. It was the insult of it all. His father's final slap in the face. Game, set, and match to Mona. She was perfectly content to have John living at the house. The arrangement bound him to her. Walker was willing to bet she was still sticking it to him any way she could. Eventually, she'd put the place on the market, but for the time being, it was a nice vacation spot when she or the girls felt like a jaunt to the West Coast. The drive continued in silence. Occasionally, Brent flicked a look in the rearview mirror. Walker leaned his head back against the seat. He was aware of Brent's scrutiny, but he made no remark. It wasn't up to him to explain his complicated family life. How had this happened? Everything was fine. Everything was good. And then, in one swift stroke, he realized he was going under. An unseen force, subtle and relentless, had taken him unawares, and now he was being dragged toward open water with no way back. He tried to reason with himself as a defense against fear. There was no reason to think Kinsey Milhone had talked to his dad. How would she do that? Carolyn said she hadn't given her any information, certainly no means by which she could have tracked him down. And even if she did, and she asked about the dog, what would his father be expected to remember? The man was old. He'd been retired for years. In the course of his practice, he'd seen hundreds of animals. What kind of a threat could she be? Walker leaned forward as Brent turned into Valley Oaks. It's this lane on the right, number 17. You can pull into the parking pad and wait. It should be half an hour or so. Brent shut down the engine and Walker got out. He hadn't seen his father since the accident, and while he dreaded the coming conversation, he had no other way of finding out if Kinsey Milhone had succeeded in reaching him. He could see his father peering at him from the window as he came up the walk. Walter opened the door, standing erect, his manner cautious. He seemed to be avoiding the sight of Walker's facial bruises, which Walker tended to forget about. "I didn't expect to see you." "Sorry about that, Dad. I should have called. But I was in the neighborhood and thought I'd stop by. There's something I'd like to ask about."
"Come in, come in," Walter said, stepping back. "You have time for a cup of coffee?"
"I could probably manage that," he said. "Don't go to any trouble."
"No trouble.
Let's go back to the great room where you can make yourself comfortable.
How are Carolyn and the children?"
"Doing well, thanks. I just came from the house, as a matter of fact. And yourself?"
"Tolerable. That pain in my hip is largely gone, and I've been increasing my walks. I'm up to 2 miles these days."
Walker perched on the couch and watched as his father set about putting together a pot of coffee, carefully filling a carafe of water, which he poured into the tank.
He added 6 small scoops of ground coffee, double-checking everything before he pressed the button that set the coffee maker in brewing mode. His father returned to the sitting area. "Coffee will take a minute," he remarked. Walker couldn't think of a response. He was casting about for some way to introduce the subject of the accident and all its attendant horrors. His father cleared his throat. "I don't suppose I need to tell you how distressed I am about this recent business of yours. Carolyn stopped by and told me. She made a special point of coming over because she didn't want me to hear about it from a third party. I appreciate her consideration. I would have told you myself, but I've been down for the count." "Yes." The word seemed like a non sequitur. Walker had hoped for some help getting through the awkwardness of the discussion. "I was horrified, as you might imagine, and rightly so. If your mother were alive, this would break her heart. Well, I guess we can both be grateful she was spared," Walker said. Wrong tone, he thought. He tried again. "I understand how upset you must be, but I've been knocked to my knees as well. How do you think I feel, knowing that poor girl is dead because of me?" "Carolyn said you blanked on all of it." "I had a concussion. I was knocked unconscious. The doctor says amnesia is pretty common under the circumstances." "Carolyn believes you suffered an alcoholic blackout, which is a horse of another color." "That's ridiculous. I didn't black out." "Perhaps not. I thought she made a good case." "Well, I'm glad the two of you had such a happy chat at my expense. She's entitled to her opinion. She's hardly the reigning expert son. You'd be wise to cut the sarcasm. She's a wonderful woman, and you're fortunate you have her standing by you." "I don't know where you got the impression she was standing by me. She's barely civil." "I'm sure she'll come around in time. You have the children to think of. It would be a pity if this tragedy ruined their lives as well as hers." The coffee was done, and his father left the sitting area to attend to cups and saucers. He set up a tray with a sugar bowl, a cream pitcher, and 2 spoons. While he was occupied, Walker debated how best to approach the matter of Kinsey Milhone. The name had no more than crossed his mind when he glanced down at the coffee table and saw her business card propped up against a potted plant. He picked it up, noting her office address and phone number. There was nothing about the kinds of cases she handled. Walker fingered the card. His father returned with the tray, cups rattling against the saucers as he walked. He set the tray on the table and passed a cup to Walker. "I forgot what you take with your coffee. I have half and half." "Black's fine," he said. "What's this?" "What's what?" "This is what I wanted to ask. Carolyn told me a private investigator called the house looking for you. According to my attorney, a conversation with this woman would be out of line." "I've already met with her, and you needn't be alarmed. Her reasons for seeing me had nothing to do with you. She stopped by a few days ago and asked about a dog I treated once upon a time." "A dog?" "She had questions about the protocol when a pet was put down. I told her what I could, and she left her card in case I had something to add. She was a very pleasant young woman. We chatted for a bit about this and that, and then she left. I doubt she was here 30 minutes, if that." "Did she mention I went to high school with her?" "I wasn't aware of it. She was here on an entirely separate matter." "What did you tell her?" His father stopped with the cup halfway to his lips. "I'm quite capable of having a conversation independent of your oversight." "Sorry. I didn't mean to butt in. I don't want her to take advantage of our prior acquaintance. Your name didn't come up. She sought me out of her own accord, though it's no concern of yours. I suggest you get your own house in order and let me worry about mine." He let the subject drop, stung by the rebuke. The conversation bumbled on until he felt enough time had passed to make his excuses and return to the car. His father declined to walk him to the door. He was barely aware of the drive home.
He rolled down the nearest window and let the air whip through the car's interior, cooling his face and buffeting his hair. He loosened his tie and unbuttoned the collar of his shirt. Brent shot him a look in the rearview mirror. Walker didn't feel he had to explain. He was hot. What business was that of Brent's? The same thoughts assailed him persistently. Kinsey knew about the dog. He couldn't figure out how she'd arrived at his father's door. By what circuitous logic had she linked his father and the dog's remains? Walker had seen her at the dig, and within a week, she was six steps behind him and gaining. By the time Brent dropped him off at the Pelican, the combination of caffeine and anxiety had triggered something close to a panic attack. Walker locked the door behind him and staggered to the bed. His heart was thudding at a rate that made him pant and sweat. It was like an overdose of speed, which he'd experienced twice in his lifelong association with drink and drugs. He sat on the edge of the bed, clutching his chest, afraid to stand up again for fear of passing out. He was dying. He would die. The terror would mount until it crushed him under its weight. 7 days sober. He wondered if it was possible to make it even one more hour. There was a cocktail lounge 2 blocks away. He pictured the quick walk, the glittering rows of bottles behind the bar. The lighting would be muted, and he doubted he'd see anyone he knew. One drink would calm him. One drink would tide him over to the next day. Mornings were easier anyway, though the day would stretch before him like eternity. All he had to do was get up, cross the room, walk the 2 blocks to the bar. His hands began to shake. He picked up the phone and called Leonard. Chapter 25. Monday, April 18th, 1988. Monday afternoon, I dialed information and picked up a phone number for Dancer Custom Woodwork in Belicia. Deborah hadn't given me the business name, but when I checked the local Yellow Pages, most custom cabinet makers seem to use their own last names by way of a designation. I was prepared to try Dancer Woodworking, Dancer Cabinetry, and variations on that theme. Fortunately, I hit it the first time out. I punched in the number, and the line rang twice before a man picked up. Dancer Custom Woodwork. Is this Sean Dancer? It is. Who's this? My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator in Santa Teresa. Deborah Unruh suggested I talk to you about Greg and Shelley. Would you be willing to meet with me? I can save you a trip. Anything I know, I can tell you by phone. It doesn't amount to much. I'd be happier talking face to face if it's all the same to you. I won't ask for any more time than you're willing to spare. Up to you, he said. He gave me his work address and said he'd be in the shop all of Tuesday and Wednesday. He had an installation on Thursday, so he'd be gone Thursday and Friday. I told him Tuesday afternoon would be fine. Stacy had called that morning to tell me Grand's private investigator was still in business, operating out of the same office he'd occupied at the time. My plan was to stop first in Lompoc and talk to Hale Brandenburg, then drive the additional 50 miles north to Belicia, covering both sources in one day. Tuesday morning, I gassed up my car and hit the northbound 101. I had the manila envelope of letters on the passenger seat, along with the invoices Brandenburg had submitted. I assumed there'd once been reports attached, but he might have agreed to convey his findings verbally to avoid written accounts. I've done the same thing myself when the issues are sensitive and a paper trail seems unwise. As long as the client is satisfied, I can work either way. I keep a set of notes for my own files as a hedge against an investigation coming back to bite me in the butt, but the client doesn't need to know. The drive was uneventful. The day was gorgeous. Temperatures in the low 70s with a light breeze coming off the ocean. I'd had the Mustang serviced the week before, and the car was driving like a dream. We'd had intermittent rain in February and March, and the rolling hills on either side of the road had turned a lush green. 35 miles later, I took the 132 off-ramp and drove west toward Vandenberg Air Force Base. The town of Lompoc boasts a population of roughly 36,000, with single-family homes ranging in price from $225,000 to $250,000. There's a small airport, a U.S. penitentiary, an attractive public library, pocket parks, good schools, and 3% more single men than single women, if you happen to be husband hunting. The surrounding area produces half the flower seeds grown in the world, which means that in May, thousands of acres of flowers are visible from the road. This was early in the season, but in another couple of months, the fields would be sprouting the colors of a Persian carpet. The business district was low-key, with wide streets and few structures over two stories high. Hale Brandenburg was on the second floor of a chunky office building. At ground level, to the right, there was a real estate company, its front windows papered with photographs of houses for sale. On the left, a title company. A glass-paneled door between the two opened onto a wide carpeted staircase. The directory posted on the wall showed his suite number as 204. I went up the stairs, marveling at the proportions of the place. The windows in the upper hallway were huge, and the ceilings were easily 20 feet high. A race of giants could have moved in and had headroom to spare. The corridor was dead quiet. I counted 8 offices, each entrance marked by a transom above the door. The old-world equivalent of air conditioning. I was taking a chance he'd be out, but when I tapped on his door and then opened it to stick my head in, he was sitting on the floor in the middle of his one-room suite, rubbing saddle soap into one of 2 worn leather-upholstered chairs. His office was sparsely furnished, leather-topped desk, the 2 leather chairs, and a bank of filing cabinets. His windows, like those in the corridor, were big and bare, spotlessly clean, revealing an uninterrupted expanse of blue sky. I caught sight of a patch of green across the street, trees just leafing out. "Housekeeping chores," he said, explaining his homely activity. "So I see. Mind if I come in?" He was a rangy-looking man, somewhere in his 60s, with a thin face and a cleft in his chin. His fair hair, cropped short, was threaded with gray. He wore faded jeans and cowboy boots, a western cut shirt and a string tie. He looked like he'd be happier outdoors, preferably on horseback. He'd finished conditioning one of the leather chairs and was working on the second. The sections he'd finished looked darker and more supple. "If you're looking for Ned, he's across the hall." "I'm looking for you, if you're Hale Brandenburg." "You selling something?" "No." "Serving papers?" "I'm looking for information." "Come on in and have a seat. You can use my desk chair, since it's the only one available. You mind if I work while we talk?" "Fine with me," I said. Taking advantage of his offer, I circled his desk and sat. His swivel chair was upholstered where mine was not, but I felt at home anyway because the squeaks were similar. As I watched, I was struck by a sense of familiarity. "I know you. Don't I know you?"
"I get that a lot. People tell me I look like the Marlboro man." I laughed.
"You do." He moved his rag across the tin of saddle soap, which he applied to the chair arm with a circular motion.
"You have a name?"
"Oh, sorry, Kinsey Milhone. I'm a PI from Santa Teresa." "Are you sure we haven't met? I could swear I've run into you, maybe a professional meeting."
"I don't do those. Do you socialize up here?"
"I hardly socialize anywhere."
"Nor do I. So, what can I do for you?"
"Does my name ring a bell?" He took his time answering.
"Possibly, though the context escapes me. Refresh my memory."
"You worked for my grandmother once upon a time, Cornelia Kinsey," He moved from the side of the chair to the back, the leather looking almost wet as he rubbed in the saddle soap.
What makes you think I worked for her?
I have the invoices.
Mrs. Kinsey still alive?
Yes.
I'm not at liberty to discuss her business without her consent.
Admirable.
You said you're a PI. You must find yourself in the same boat every now and then.
As a matter of fact, it happened in the last 2 weeks.
Then I don't have to spell out the ethical implications. She paid for the information. It belongs to her.
Don't you think the statute of limitations has run out where I'm concerned?
Depends on what you want to know.
I opened the manila envelope and dumped the letters on his desk. Know what these are?
Not from down here. You want to hold something up where I can see it?
I picked up a handful of letters which I fanned out and held in view. Some of these were sent to my Aunt Jin and some to me. All of them were returned unopened. Well, except the first. It looks like Aunt Jin read that one before she put it back in the mail to Grand.
You steal them?
No. But I would have given half a chance. A cousin of mine came across them when she was going through my grandfather's files. I figured the letters are mine, since they're addressed to me.
You'd have to take that up with an attorney. I'm not well versed in the laws governing intellectual property, he said.
What happened to Virginia Kinsey?
She died 15 years ago.
Ah. Well, I'm sorry to hear. I was the sole beneficiary of her estate, which means her letters are mine as well.
You won't catch me arguing the point.
Did you know her?
I met her in the line of duty, so to speak.
You want to hear my theory?
I can't prevent you from voicing an opinion.
In the 2 or 3 years after my parents' death, my grandmother was hell-bent on gaining custody of me. It's all in the letters. I'm guessing you were hired to investigate my Aunt Jin in hopes of impugning her parenting ability. Hale Brandenburg said nothing. His rag went around and around while he squinted in the manner of a man who's accustomed to working with a cigarette in one corner of his mouth. He was a type I'd run across before, the rugged outdoor sort. His humor was dry and understated, and his persona had a comforting appeal.
No comment? I asked. Don't think so. I understand your interest, but the same principle applies. You want the information, talk to your granny.
She's in her 90s and losing it, from what I hear. I doubt she'd remember what you did for her.
That doesn't mean I'm free to discuss it with you.
Mr. Brandenburg, in less than a month, I'll be 38 years old. I'm not up for adoption, so I don't see what difference it could possibly make if you confirmed what I've said.
He smiled faintly. The name's Hale, and you have a point. At your age, I'm sure the court would take your wishes into consideration before making a decision about placement.
That's safely non-responsive. What if I ask about process instead of content?
You could try.
What happened to the written reports? I've got invoices, but nothing else.
There weren't any.
How so? He smiled.
I'd have to cite confidentiality again.
Were you supposed to grab me and run?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't have hired out if that was the point.
I sorted through the invoices. She paid you close to $4,000.
Put in a lot of hours.
Doing what? He was quiet, and I could see him brooding. I said, look, this is all ancient history. There's nothing at stake. Whatever Gran's intentions, she couldn't have succeeded because here I sit. He was quiet for a moment more.
Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
Surprised, I said, sure, I'd like that. I pictured a coffee shop, but Hale had something else in mind. We went into the lobby of an office building 3 doors down. In one corner there was a coffee cart complete with wee containers of half and half, sugar packets, stirring sticks, and freshly baked cinnamon buns. He glanced at me. "Have you had lunch?" "It's 10 a.m. He smiled. "How about a sticky bun?"
"Sure, why not? I skipped breakfast this morning along with my 3-mile run."
He pointed to 3 big cinnamon buns that the woman behind the cart picked up with a sheet of waxed paper and placed in a sack. He asked for 2 jumbo coffees to go, which she poured, and then set in a collapsible cardboard tray. He picked up a handful of half-and-half containers the size and shape of bonbons, and then he added a pile of sugar packets. After he paid, I followed him out the lobby door, and from there to the grassy park across the street. I got the impression this was his morning ritual. The bench he chose was in dappled shade. By the time he sat down, setting the cardboard tray between us, a Disney-like assortment of birds and squirrels had appeared in anticipation of the 3rd pastry, apparently intended for them. Our conversation proceeded by fits and starts, while we sipped coffee and munched on sticky buns, tossing nuggets to the little creatures gathered at his feet. "You understand, I could have my license yanked if this got back to her."
"How would it get back to her? I won't breathe a word of it. Scout's honor."
He sat and thought about it. "What the hell? I'm close to retirement. I'll take you at your word."
"Please."
"You're right about the job. Mrs. Kinsey hired me to do a background check on Virginia.
She wanted proof Aunt Jen was unfit to act as my guardian, right?"
"Basically. Your grandmother had enough money to pay for the best attorneys. Still does, for that matter. She also had enough to pay for my services, which didn't come cheap, as you so kindly pointed out. She thought she could influence the social workers and the judge, and she wasn't too far wrong. Virginia Kinsey was an odd duck."
"Eccentric is the word," I said. "So, what went on?"
He smiled, conceding the point. "Your parents left no instructions about guardianship if something happened to them. Your aunt had no experience with kids. You must have discovered that yourself if you had half a brain. She was one of a kind. She could knock back whiskey with the best of them, and she cussed like a stevedore. I could have made a case for your grandmother being the better equipped to care for a 5-year-old.
"Is that what you did?"
"No."
"What happened?"
"I'll get to that in a bit. 2 things I should tell you first. I didn't like your grandmother then, and I don't like her now. Maybe she reminds me too much of my own granny, who was stingy and bad-tempered, as hateful as they come. Mrs. Kinsey's the same, self-centered, autocratic, which won't fly with me. I've worked for her a time or 2 after that job, but it's been years now, which is why I asked if she was still alive."
"Fair enough.
Here's the other thing. That was the only job I ever did strictly for the money. I was just getting into the business. I'd borrowed from the bank to set up my office, but clients weren't exactly breaking down my door. The loan officer, the cranky so-and-so, expected payment, and I didn't have a dime. I put him off as long as I could, but I was running out of excuses. I don't know what the bank would have done if I'd defaulted. I figured the last thing they wanted was an empty office filled with my used furniture. I knew the location was good, and I was convinced I'd have business enough to support myself, at least modestly, within a short period of time. I just didn't have the cash in hand. Mrs. Kinsey came along and told me what she had in mind. Even as desperate as I was, I didn't want to work for her, so I named an exorbitant price. She agreed to pay it, and I was stuck. I sat surveillance on Virginia off and on for weeks, first in 1955, then again in 56 and early 57. In truth, I never saw your aunt as a motherly type. She provided you with the basics, but I didn't witness much in the way of affection.
I can testify to that. He smiled. You were a tiny little thing, and you clung to her like a monkey. So much so that I wondered about your emotional stability. You'd taken a hit. The loss of your parents was a blow I wasn't sure you'd recover from. Virginia wasn't nurturing, but she was solid and she was constant. She was also a firecracker when it came to protecting you. In my opinion, that was enough.
You decided all this sitting in a car parked down the street from us?
Not quite. I'd been out there less than a week when she spotted me. I thought I'd been discreet, but she was sharp. She must have known her mother was up to no good. One day she came out to the car, gestured I should roll the window down, and then invited me in. She said if I was going to spy on her, I might as well do it up close and net myself a cup of coffee in the bargain. After that, she knew I was following her, but she made no concessions. She did exactly what she always did. What I thought of her and what I reported was of no concern.
I'm missing something here, I said. My grandmother was ancient even then. What made her think she had any chance of gaining custody?
It was the other way around. She thought she had the means to knock your Aunt Jin out of the running. If she managed to do that, who else was going to step in?
My mother was the oldest of five girls. Aunt Jin was next, and after her was Sarah, Maura, and Susanna. I should think any one of them would have been preferable.
They were financially dependent on the senior Kinseys. All the girls made respectable marriages, but their husbands didn't have the kind of money your grandparents did. As I heard the story, Sarah and Maura didn't approve of your mother anyway, and neither one of them was willing to defy Mrs. Kinsey once they knew she wanted you.
What kind of leverage did she have, aside from that? I'm still not getting it.
I've probably said enough.
Come on. Don't you ever give up?
It doesn't hurt to ask. I figure you'll tell me as much or as little as you want. He took a bite of sticky bun and chewed for a while, then took a sip of coffee. Your grandmother believed Virginia was a lesbian.
I stared at him, astonished. You're not serious.
You asked about leverage. That was it. In those days, the accusation was damaging, even if there wasn't any proof. That's why I wouldn't give her written reports. I didn't want Mrs. Kinsey to have anything to hold over Virginia's head.
Aunt Jin was gay?
That's not what I said. I said I wouldn't put anything in writing one way or the other.
How did she come up with the notion in the first place?
I have no idea. When she came to my office, she told me what she wanted, which was to get the goods on her daughter. That was the phrase she used. She said no judge would permit custody to go to someone of such a bent. I told her I wouldn't tailor my findings to suit her purposes. She said she'd be happy to hire someone else who'd give her what she was paying for. I told her I didn't give a shit who she hired. If she didn't care about the truth, she wouldn't be doing business with me.
She let you talk to her that way?
She took offense. But I think she liked it. Hardly anyone stood up to her in those days.
They still don't. Go on with your story.
She was irritated. But in the end, she agreed. The thing about her, she was an egomaniac. But there was a line she was hesitant to cross. Virginia was still a Kinsey. If your grandmother was right, exposing Virginia would be an embarrassment to her as well as to the rest of the family.
You're saying if she was right, she wouldn't have used the information?
Not publicly, no. I was worried she would do something underhanded. She was devious, and I didn't want to give her the ammunition.
So you told her Aunt Jin was straight?
She was.
I squinted at him. Are you leveling with me?
Why wouldn't I? To me, the idea was ridiculous. There was never a shred of evidence Virginia Kinsey was anything other than a dyed-in-the-wool heterosexual. She preferred being single, but that's not aberrant behavior. A lot of folks are like that. I'm one.
Me too, I said. I don't understand why Grant would even raise the question.
Must have been the worst thing she could think of. So, naturally, she wanted it to be true.
As old-fashioned and proper as she seems, I can't believe she even knew about such things.
Don't kid yourself. Even Victorian women had their special friends. When two single women settled in together, eyebrows went up. The arrangement was referred to as a Boston marriage.
Did Aunt Jen know what Grand was up to?
I believe she did.
I don't know what to do with this. For years, I've been feeling sorry for myself because I thought my grandmother didn't give a shit. Now, it looks like she cared so much, she'd have blackmailed her own daughter to achieve her ends.
That's about the size of it. On the bright side, she failed.
Yeah. And on the dark side, look at what it cost. My poor Aunt Jen. I had no idea what she was going through. She made sure no whisper of it ever reached my ears. For years, I wasn't aware I had family beyond her. I only learned about my relatives when she was gone. A woman of contradictions. Forthright and secretive in the same breath. I studied him, wondering if I was missing something. I don't want you bending the truth. I'm truly fine with it either way.
Why so suspicious? You must have trust issues, as they're referred to in the common parlance.
I laughed. Maybe. And what about you?
You'd have to be a fool to trust most people. I credit myself with more intelligence.
I glanced at my watch. Oops, I have a meeting in Belicia, so I should hit the road.
I appreciate your confidence. My lips are sealed. I made a zipping motion across my mouth.
Hale wadded up the paper sack and tossed it in the trash.
If you have other questions, don't hesitate to call.
It wasn't until I was on the road again that I realized he hadn't actually answered my question about whether he'd lie.
Chapter 26. The business address Sean Dancer had given me in Belicia turned out to be his home address as well. The town itself was small, spread out like a net between the highway and the beach. The main source of income was the tourist trade. Visitors attracted by the setting and the work of local artisans, who made everything from cheeses to breads to boutique wines. I spotted 7 art galleries on the main thoroughfare, where there were also shops selling jewelry, handmade furniture, textiles, and other one-of-a-kind crafts. Countless small hotels and bed-and-breakfast places lined the narrow streets, with high-end restaurants, cafes, and bistros sufficient to service the locals as well as the numerous travelers who'd come to explore the area. At this time of year, the rates were reasonable, and I saw a number of no-vacancy signs. Sean Dancer lived in a 1-story gray-painted frame house, with a suggestion of Victoriana in its steep gables, fish-scale shingled roof, and gingerbread trim. I pulled up in front and parked. I knocked at the front door and waited the requisite few minutes, wondering if anyone was home. The door was opened by a young woman I judged to be scarcely out of her teens. She was just a slip of a thing, with large hazel eyes and a halo of black curls. She was barefoot, wearing cutoffs and a t-shirt that she'd knotted in front. Her right arm was weighted with silver bracelets. I said, "Hi, I hope I have the right house here. I'm looking for Sean. He's in his shop around back." Since she offered nothing else, I thanked her and then went down the porch steps, turned right, and followed the drive. The workshop was the main house in miniature, connected by a breezeway. The door was standing open and the scent of glue and raw wood perfumed the air. I could hear the high-pitched singing of a lathe. Sean, in coveralls and goggles, was intent on his task, which allowed me a moment to study him without his being aware. He was tall,
with a mop of dark, curly hair. The seams of his white coveralls were etched in sawdust. Unacquainted as I was with the tools of his trade, I could still identify buffing and drilling machines, routers, planes, disc sanders, miter, and bandsaws. He'd glued the edge joints of two wide flat panels together, then placed them in a big C-clamp. Rough lumber was stacked